He had asked his family never to come to the mills without appointment. He had been glad that they hated the place and seldom appeared in his office. What he now felt was a violent impulse to order his mother off the premises. Instead, with a greater effort than the problem of the train wreck had required of him, he said quietly, "All right. Ask her to come in." His mother came in with an air of belligerent defensiveness. She looked at his office as if she knew what it meant to him, and as if she were declaring her resentment against anything being of greater importance to him than her own person. She took a long time settling down in an armchair, arranging and rearranging her bag, her gloves, the folds of her dress, while droning, "It's a fine thing when a mother has to wait in an anteroom and ask permission of a stenographer before she's allowed to see her own son, who—" "Mother, is it anything important? I am very rushed today." "You're not the only one who's got problems. Of course it's important. Do you think I'd go to the trouble of driving way out here if it wasn't important?"
"What is it?"
"It's about Philip."
"Yes?"
"Philip is unhappy."
"Well?"
"He feels it's not right that he should have to depend on your charity, and live on handouts, and never be able to count on a single dollar of his own."
"Well," he said with a startled smile, "I've been waiting for him to realize that.
It isn't right for a sensitive man to be in such a position."
"It certainly isn't."
"I'm glad you agree with me. So what you have to do is give him a job."
What?
"You must give him a job here at the mills, but a nice, clean job, of course, with a desk and an office and a decent salary, where he wouldn't have to be among your day laborers and your smelly furnaces."
He knew that he was hearing it. He could not make himself believe it.
"Mother, you're not serious." "I certainly am. I happen to know that that's what he wants, only he's too proud to ask you for it. But if you offer it to him, and make it look like it's you who are asking him a favor, why, I know he'd be happy to take it. That's why I had to come up here to talk to you, so he wouldn't guess that I put you up to it."
It was not in the nature of his consciousness to understand the nature of the things he was hearing. A single thought cut through his mind like a spotlight, making him unable to conceive how any eyes could miss it. The thought broke out of him as a cry of bewilderment. "But he knows nothing about the steel business."
"What has that got to do with it? He needs a job."
"But he couldn't do the work."
"He needs to gain self-confidence and to feel important."
"But he wouldn't be any good whatever."
"He needs to feel that he's wanted."
"Here? What could I want him for?"
"You hire plenty of strangers."
"I hire men who produce."
"What has he got to offer?"
"He's your brother, isn't he?"
"What has that got to do with it?"
She stared incredulously in turn, silenced by shock. For a moment they sat looking at each other, as if across an interplanetary distance.
"He's your brother," she said,
her voice like a phonograph record, repeating a magic formula she could not permit herself to doubt.
"He needs a position in the world. He needs a salary so that he'd feel that he's got money coming to him as his due, not his alms."
"As his due? But he wouldn't be worth a nickel to me."
"Is that what you think of first? Your profit? I'm asking you to help your brother, and you're figuring how to make a nickel on him, and you won't help him unless there's money in it for you, is that it?"
She saw the expression of his eyes, and she looked away, but spoke hastily, her voice rising.
"Yes, sure, you're helping him. Like you'd help any stray beggar. Material help, that's all you know or understand. Have you thought about his spiritual needs, and what his position is doing to his self-respect? He doesn't want to live like a beggar. He wants to be independent of you."
"By means of getting, from me, a salary he can't earn, for work he can't do."
"You'd never miss it. You've got enough people here who are making money for you."
"Are you asking me to help him stage a fraud of that kind?"
"You don't have to put it that way."
"Is it a fraud, or isn't it?"
"That's why I can't talk to you, because you're not human. You have no pity, no feeling for your brother, no compassion for his feelings."
"Is it a fraud or not?"
"You have no mercy for anybody."
"Do you think that a fraud of this kind would be just?"
"You're the most immoral man living. You think of nothing but justice. You don't feel any love at all."
He got up, his movement, abrupt and stressed. The movement of ending an interview and ordering a visitor out of his office. Mother, I'm running a steel plant, not a whorehouse.
Henry!
The gasp of indignation was at his choice of language, nothing more. Don't ever speak to me again about a job for Philip. I would not give him the job of a cinder sweeper. I would not allow him inside my mills. I want you to understand that once and for all. You may try to help him in any way you wish, but don't ever let me see you thinking of my mills as a means to that end. The wrinkles of her soft chin trickled into a shape resembling a sneer.
What are they, your mills? A holy temple of some kind?
Why? Yes, he said softly, astonished at the thought.
Don't you ever think of people, and of your moral duties?
I don't know what it is that you choose to call morality. No, I don't think of people, except that if I gave a job to Philip, I wouldn't be able to face any competent man who needed work and deserved it. She got up. Her head was drawn into her shoulders, and the righteous bitterness of her voice seemed to push the words upward at his tall, straight figure.
That's your cruelty. That's what's mean and selfish about you. If you loved your brother, you'd give him a job he didn't deserve precisely because he didn't deserve it. That would be true love and kindness and brotherhood. Else what's love for? If a man deserves a job, there's no virtue in giving it to him. Virtue is the giving of the undeserved.
He was looking at her like a child at an unfamiliar nightmare, incredulity preventing it from becoming horror. Mother, he said slowly, you don't know what you're saying. I'm not able ever to despise you enough to believe that you mean it. The look on her face astonished him more than all the rest. It was a look of defeat, and yet of an odd, sly, cynical cunning, as if for a moment she held some worldly wisdom that mocked his innocence. The memory of that look remained in his mind, like a warning signal telling him that he had glimpsed an issue which he had to understand. But he could not grapple with it. He could not force his mind to accept it as worthy of thought. He could find no clue except his dim uneasiness and his revulsion. And he had no time to give it. He could not think of it now. He was facing his next caller seated in front of his desk. He was listening to a man who pleaded for his life. The man did not state it in such terms, but Reardon knew that that was the essence of the case. What the man put into words was only a plea for 500 tons of steel. He was Mr. Ward, of the Ward Harvester Company of Minnesota. It was an unpretentious company with an unblemished reputation, the kind of business concern that seldom grows large, but never fails. Mr. Ward represented the fourth generation of a family that had owned the plant and had given it the conscientious best of such ability as they possessed. He was a man in his 50s, with a square, stolid face. Looking at him, one knew that he would consider it as indecent to let his face show suffering as to remove his clothes in public. He spoke in a dry, business-like manner. He explained that he had always dealt, as his father had, with one of the small steel companies now taken over by Orrin Boyle's Associated Steel. He had waited for his last order of steel for a year. He had spent the last month struggling to obtain a personal interview with Reardon.
"I know that your mills are running at capacity, Mr. Reardon," he said, "and I know that you are not in a position to take care of new orders, what with your biggest, oldest customers having to wait their turn. You being the only decent, I mean reliable, steel manufacturer left in the country. I don't know what reason to offer you as to why you should want to make an exception in my case, but there was nothing else for me to do except close the doors of my plant for good. And I..."
There was a slight break in his voice.
"I can't quite see my way to closing the doors, as yet. So I thought I'd speak to you, even if I didn't have much chance. Still, I had to try everything possible."
This was language that Reardon could understand.
"I wish I could help you out," he said, "but this is the worst possible time for me, because of a very large, very special order that has to take precedence over everything."
"I know. But would you just give me a hearing, Mr. Reardon?"
"Sure."
"If it's a question of money, I'll pay anything you ask. If I could make it worth your while that way, why, charge me any extra you please. Charge me double the regular price. Only let me have the steel. I wouldn't care if I had to sell the harvester at a loss this year, just so I could keep the doors open. I've got enough personally to run at a loss for a couple of years, if necessary, just to hold out. Because I figure things can't go on this way much longer. Conditions are bound to improve. They've got to, or else we'll... He did not finish. He said firmly, "They've got to." "They will," said Reardon.